We'll pretend that you and I are going to play blackjack together as a team. We're not opponents, but as a team. And we're going to split the winnings 50-50 because we're friends. All right?
Yep.
So we go to the table and we each put a dollar on the same hand of blackjack. We don't know if we're going to win. We don't know how long it's going to take to win. We don't know how much we're going to win. We're confident we're going to win. Otherwise, we wouldn't be playing.
Right.
We don't know for sure. So the dealer deals two aces. So we're going to split those aces and double down. But I'm out of cash. You're not. So you put two more dollars down. If we win, does 50-50 sound fair?
It doesn't.
It doesn't. It should be 75-25.
Yeah.
That's a logical, obvious, unambiguous conclusion that our share of the winnings should be based on our share of the bets.
Yeah.
So in a startup, all you're doing is betting on ideas. And we're betting our time and our money and our relationships and our facilities and our supplies and our equipment. Every time we contribute to a startup and we're not paid a fair market rate for that contribution, it's essentially a bet.
You're listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. This is your seat at the table. Welcome to the show. This is Darren Clark, the producer, and today we are pleased to have serial entrepreneur, professor, and author of The Slicing Pie Handbook, Mike Moyer. Now, if you've ever lost all your money or got an unfair share, or if you've ever wondered how to put a value on sweat equity, and especially if you're setting up a startup, this is a vital episode. If this podcast is helpful to you in your life and business, please be sure to hit subscribe and leave us a review and go to businesslunchpodcast.com for more. Thank you for tuning in and let's begin.
Hey, everybody. It is Roland Frazier here with Business Lunch Podcast. I'm very excited to welcome my guest today, Mike Moyer. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate being here.
Thanks for being here. You have authored a couple of really cool resources for entrepreneurs, particularly in starting up. And it came as a result, I know, of your experiences. And I just love the concept of the whole dynamic allocation of equity thing and how things change, because I'm a recovering attorney. And I see in deals that I put together long ago where partnership disputes could arise because different people got allocated their equity too soon. And then things happened that caused things to change. And you've got a really cool process and system for making that much, much easier to deal with, right?
Yes, thank you very much. That's exactly what it's for.
Yeah, it's so cool. Would you tell us a little bit about your background and then how you came up with this concept, and then we'll dive into it?
Sure. I've been an entrepreneur most of my career. I started a company in college making t-shirts, and then I moved to manufacturing like outdoor clothing. And I managed bands and did a bunch of stuff. And I always struggled with this idea of taking on partners. And when people wanted to join my company, they wanted a piece of it. I just said, I'll just pay you and you just work for me and we'll just do it like that. Mm-hmm. And I started my first company. I sold my first company out of college. I made a little money and then invested in the stock market, made a little more money, which is great. And then I went and started a new company and I invested all of my money into that. And I had kind of a weird equity deal with my partners and the company went under. And I lost all my money. And then I joined a new startup. And less than a year later, I made it all back. So it was a real roller coaster for me. But I never really got a handle on how the equity split. Because the money that I made back, I really shouldn't have made that much money, given that I was only there for less than a year. And people at my level were there for 5 years. And they made the same amount of money that I did. So it seemed a little bit unfair. But I didn't know who to give the money back to, of course.
Right.
So I kept it. And then I started a company a few years later and we raised $5 million with a half-written business plan and a PowerPoint deck. And my partner, who was much more experienced than I was, even then, made some kind of weird clauses in the contract, which gave him some weird powers. And when I left the company, all of my shares vested. They accelerated vesting, which is very common. You know, certain circumstances, you'll vest your shares. And he called me back a few days later and said, oh, by the way, on our third revision to our second operating agreement, there was a clause in there, one line out of, 80 pages that allows me to buy your shares back. So I guess I'm going to do that. But he said, but wait, I want you to, you're really instrumental in this company, so I don't want to take all everything back. So he gave me a little bit of shares, and last year he bought them all back out and sold them for probably 10 times as much as he bought them for.
Like, I just kind of want to screw you. I don't want to completely screw you. I just want to mostly screw you.
It felt like that. And yeah. It turns out every manager got treated that way.
Wow.
And that was about 10 years ago. And I sat down and I wrote kind of a rant on why this model didn't work. And all along the way, I'd asked lawyers and professors and advisors and well-meaning, experienced, smart people, my uncle or whatever, how do you do this? And it was always the same answer. Who's going to contribute what, and what are your financials going to look like? And this, all these forward-thinking statements. Mm-hmm. And the answer to all those questions was, I have no idea what's going to happen.
Right.
I don't know how much money we're going to make. I don't know who's going to do what. It's a startup. And it kind of revealed itself to me that you can't base equity splits on future events because you can't predict the future.
Yes.
When you try to do that, you get it wrong. And one thing I've noticed in this is this, when you do equity splits on the outside of the venture, it's comforting to know what you want, what you're going to get. The problem is it's always going to be the wrong number.
Right.
Or with a dynamic split, you don't know what you're going to get, but you can rest assured that whatever you get, it's going to be the right number. So that's the real difference there. Is if you put it in properly, you'll always get what you deserve. So that's where I came up with the slicing pie model and sort of the books associated with it.
Yeah, and so for everybody that's watching or listening, Slicing Pie was the first book that you wrote about this, correct?
Yep.
And then it's kind of evolved a little bit since then. So you have a workbook.
The Slicing Pie Handbook, it came out in 2015. And I'm working on a new book called Will Work for Pie that should be out in December if I can get my act together.
I love that. What's the evolution between when you first did this and then documented it all in the Slicing Pie and then doing the handbook and now the new WWFP?
Well, I wrote the first white paper in 2010 and I distributed it to everybody I knew and it got really good response. So I decided to write a book on the topic. I wrote the Slicing Pie book first. And I originally envisioned it as kind of a hacker resource framework where people kind of change it as they saw fit. But I slowly began to realize that fairness is not a matter of opinion. It's a matter of facts.
Yes.
There aren't multiple versions of fairness. So you can't change things. I can't change something and have it turn out fair. So like if our dad gives us a cookie, the three of us, we're going to split it a third, a third, a third, because we each paid the equal amounts of nothing to get it. There's no other way to do it. Now you could give me your half or your share, but then your generosity doesn't make it more fair.
Right.
And you should have decision-making rights over that third of the cookie. So there aren't multiple versions of fairness. So with the second book, I cleaned up the language a little bit and kind of wrote it that way. The first book has been translated in like 10 different languages, so I didn't want to monkey with it too much. But I wish I had, because there's two books on Amazon. They compete with one another now.
Oh, okay. So what's the major difference? What were the major insights between the first in 2010 and the second in 2015, right? 5-year spread between them?
It's the same basic model. There's a term I use in the first book called theoretical value, mm-hmm. which I replaced with a term called a slice, which I think is easier for people to understand, which is like a poker chip.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of recanted on a few things, like what some concepts have how to adjust the pie over time. They're fundamentally the same thing. You can read either book and you'd be off to the races either way.
Okay, great. And then what's going to happen in the new one that you're in the process of writing right now?
Well, I've spoken to thousands of entrepreneurs over the years, and there's very similar questions come up. Like, how do I pay an advisor is a very common question. So I'm answering how do you pay an advisor in that book. People say, I answer questions like putting together bonus programs. You know, one thing that happens after companies get funded is they have these stock option programs, and I don't think those really work the way people think they should work. They don't have the effect. You know, people think you throw stock options at someone and it'll make up for bad management. You know, they're miraculously turned into great employees, but I haven't seen evidence of that.
I agree.
I haven't seen research that supports that either. What I have seen research support is good, clear communication and clear goals and milestones and clear vision. So I've written up, you know, how to set up a bonus program. I'm talking about how to do what's called a nested pie. So a pie made of pies, how to do pies for projects. There's a lot of things. It's kind of a hodgepodge of different things that have come up over the years that I want to clarify. So it's not real cohesive in terms of a storyline.
I love it. Have you encountered anything with respect to dynamic allocation in acquisition type deals where you're integrating one company with the other and the people don't really know exactly, like they know that there's going to be some synergy by having one company go with another, but they're not sure who's going to be doing what so much or how that's going to work. Has that come up at all in the things that you've done?
It does occasionally. You know, one thing that you can do with established companies is you can set a value on them. You can do a 409A valuation, which you're probably familiar with is an accounting evaluation for stock purchase programs. That's a good place to start. with slicing pie companies, I've seen this happen a couple times, is when there's two companies using slicing pie, all they have to do is add their slices together and they're off to the races with it. So it's a really easy transaction for startups to merge.
Right.
With larger companies, you know, past break even or Series A, slicing pie doesn't apply the same way it applies to smaller companies.
Right. So what would you say are some of the, just kind of sharing with the audience, what are some of the biggest mistakes that people make that you see as they go into, well, I'd like to just say just generally, because this is the whole reason that you created this, but are there some specific mistakes that you see made again and again? And then how does slicing pie address those mistakes?
Well, the biggest mistake is probably the most common is we'll do equal splits. So the three of us will start a company, we'll do a third, a third, a third.
This sounds fair, right?
Like 90% of companies, you know, what could possibly go wrong, you know? You know, 50-50 is a clear winner there. Or they'll do 49-51 because it's your idea, so you get 51%. But, so there's always this, I call it the illusion of control.
Right.
But it's the first mistake is doing equal splits. Like that's called a fixed equity split. Even if you don't do equal splits, you know, doling out chunks of equity in advance of things going on. The second major mistake people make is they do what I call a premature valuation. So I'll sell my mom $5,000 worth of shares and she'll buy 10% of the company. Well, I've just implied the company's worth 50 grand. And even if it's not, it creates all kinds of problems, not the least of which is if I give shares to somebody else, I might be taxed on them.
Right.
And the other one is time-based vesting. Time-based vesting is a knee-jerk common thing people do. They go, we'll do 4 years and 1 year cliff. And now I have an incentive as your employer to fire you before you vest, and you as my employee have an incentive just not to lose your job. So I've given you minimal incentive to do your work.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that matters is the passage of time. And I've written a contract that gives us the wrong incentives. So if you don't intend for those incentives, why put them in a contract?
Right.
It's extremely common, but it just doesn't really have the effect. The only place it does work is just for pure retention, just to keep someone around, you know, which is fine, and that could be important.
Right.
It doesn't do anything, have anything to performance. So premature valuations, fixed equity splits, time-based vesting are some of the most common problems.
And so how does slicing pie address each of those specifically?
Well, my favorite way to describe slicing pie is a poker game. I think you and I have talked about this before, the blackjack example. So we'll pretend that you and I are going to play blackjack together as a team. We're not opponents, but as a team. And we're going to split the winnings 50-50 because we're friends. All right? Fist bump, fair and square, right?
Yep.
So we go to the table and we each put a dollar on the same hand of blackjack. We don't know if we're going to win. We don't know how long it's going to take to win. We don't know how much we're going to win. We're confident we're going to win. Otherwise, we wouldn't be playing.
Right.
We don't know for sure.
So and we know the odds are in our favor because we're playing in a casino, right?
And we're hot shots. And we know the game. We're sharks. So the dealer deals two aces. So we're going to split those aces and double down. But I'm out of cash. You're not. So you put two more dollars down. So we still don't know if we're going to win or how much we're going to win or how long it's going to take to win. All we know for sure is that you bet $3 and I bet $1. If we win, does 50-50 sound fair?
Right. Yeah, it doesn't.
It doesn't. It should be 75-25.
Yeah.
That's a logical, obvious, unambiguous conclusion that our share of the winnings should be based on our share of the bets. Now, I got a deal for 50-50. I could sue you and probably win because we agreed to it, but that didn't make it fair.
Yeah.
So in a startup, all you're doing is betting on ideas. And we're betting our time and our money and our relationships and our facilities and our supplies and our equipment. Every time we contribute to a startup and we're not paid a fair market rate for that contribution, it's essentially a bet. So with slicing pie, all you do is add up the bets and your share is equal to your bets divided by all the bets. Simple and obvious and always works.
Love it. Love it. And then how about one of the things that was interesting to me is that you treat capital contribution as not really affecting. It's mostly effort-based. If you contribute capital, you should get that capital back, but you're not getting a multiple or a return on that. Is that correct?
No, you are. So there's two kinds of contributions people can make. You can make non-cash contributions, which are things like time and your ideas and facilities and certain things,
right,
that don't require cash out of pocket. And there are cash contributions, which are basically unreimbursed expenses or cash invested. So I use a fictional unit of risk called a slice, which is just like a poker chip. It just marks a risk. It's called a slice. So every dollar in cash you put in, you get four slices in the pie. And every dollar in non-cash, you get two slices. And that's because if I paid you $50 an hour to work for me, and you wanted to buy a thing that cost $50, it would take you more than an hour to earn enough money, because when I paid you, I pay employment taxes and Social Security taxes. When you receive the money, you pay income taxes. When you buy the thing, you pay sales tax.
Right.
So I double it to smooth those out. Now, in certain cases, what you might be remembering is when you invest capital into the organization, it doesn't convert to slices because it's just sitting in the bank.
Right.
When you consume the money, it converts to slices.
Okay,
when
great.
It becomes a risk. That's probably what you're thinking of.
Okay, that is. And then as far as when things, like if someone leaves the company, you have some kind of interesting takes on that because very often there's turnover, and it would be very easy when you have several people coming in and they have all got some slice or piece of a slice, then how do you deal with that? You have a great way of doing that. Would you share that with us?
Sure. And this is one of the most heartbreaking things when somebody kind of poops out in the beginning of this deal and they negotiate some kind of payout. They're often the only one who ever makes any money.
Right.
There's a great movie called Startup.com where they invest hundreds of millions of dollars, and one of their co-founders flakes out and doesn't show up for work, and they pay him $800,000 to buy him out. Everyone else goes bankrupt except for him. So there's four reasons why you can leave a company. The first reason is you can be fired for cause, which usually means performance-based. I wasn't doing my job. And that's warning, fired. You got to give someone a chance to recover from their mistakes in order to make it fair. So warning, fired. Fired for cause. The second reason, they can be fired for no cause. So you're fired. I don't want to work with you anymore. You're doing your job as agreed, but I don't want you anymore. So you're fired, which I can do if I want.
Right.
You can also resign for a good reason. Resigning for good reason implies that you as my manager made promises that you couldn't keep. So you might have said, we're going to pay you in 6 months. 6 months, no money materializes. I have good reason to leave now. Or we're based in Austin, Texas. Pack your bags. We're moving to Seattle. Not what I signed up for, so I can leave now.
Right.
The last reason is I can quit for my own reasons. I'm just quitting out of the blue. I'm leaving you in the lurch. So if I'm fired for cause or I resign for no cause, I'm putting an undue burden on the company. I'm leaving you in the lurch. So I lose my slices for non-cash contributions. I'm essentially walking away from the business. Just like a solo founder walking away would lose everything. A partner walking away would lose everything. Except for cash would turn into a loan because we don't want to give anyone incentive to steal money. But on the flip side, if I'm fired for no good reason, or I resign for good reason, my slices stay on the table. The bet stays on the table and converts to equity with everyone else alongside. So no matter what happens, I'm properly represented on that table and that equity pool. So if I give you good reason to quit and you quit, you will get equity eventually in the company.
I love it. Are there situations where you've seen that kind of go beyond this, or just some particular situations where this concept needs to be adapted in some way or isn't the best way to approach it?
I call it a universal one-size-fits-all solution for the allocation and recovery of equity. It works every time in all situations.
I love it.
Now,
okay.
In some situations, like sometimes project-based work, like if you're making a movie or doing a consulting project, the pie terminates when the money comes in and it's all distributed and it just lasts per pie. If it's an ongoing company, then it turns to equity eventually. So there's special situations when the pie just cashes out and there's no equity instance because the pie terminates at cash out. Otherwise, it continues forever and actually until break even.
You put all of this into a thing that you refer to as a grunt fund, correct?
Yeah, the model is in the first book. I called it a grunt fund. Lots of people use the term grunt fund. It didn't translate well into other languages, though. In Russian, it was pig money.
You get the big money. I like it. So now, is that for 100% of the equity of the company, or is there typically, because there's sometimes financing people that come in and things like that. So how do you deal with capital, and how do you deal with intellectual property that's different from, say, effort and labor?
Well, everything has a fair market value. So first thing you want to do is establish the fair market value of something. And intellectual property usually comes in the form of a royalty payment. If you have pre-existing intellectual property that's sort of fixed in space in the form of a patent or a trademark or a copyright, then you can potentially license that to the organization, in which case unpaid royalties are non-cash contributions. If you want to learn how much your intellectual property is worth, go sell it to somebody. And the price you can get is what it's worth. If you can't sell it, it's either worthless or it's priceless. It's probably worthless. So you'd use intellectual property royalty payments, for instance, or acquisition price.
Okay,
you generally wouldn't give out chunks of equity to investors at that stage, because if the investor can't fund your operation, they should be given a convertible note because you don't want to set premature valuations.
Right.
I tell people that if it's an individual investing their own money in amounts that are too small to fund your operation, that's an angel investor, and right. that's you have a convertible note. The professional investor investing other people's money in amounts that are big enough is your venture capitalist, and that they should get a priced round. That's when you should give out chunks of shares. So slicing pie works until that price round happens or until break even. And all the equity, all the common stocks should be treated under the same terms.
Okay. That's a great point. So then the point in time when those investors with third party money come in is when the dynamic part gets fixed and then you move forward kind of more traditionally?
Right. So I call it baking the pie. And basically what happens is the pie naturally stops accumulating slices because now we're paying everybody. And so you just issue shares according to that split. And then it becomes your common share pool. And then slicing pie goes on to your next venture.
I love it. Now, are there any particularly interesting stories or applications that you've seen of this working in companies or solving particular challenges or anything like that? And I'm going to include in there maybe anybody who's kind of started out with a fixed allocation, but then tried to put this in to kind of fix that.
That's one of the most common things I get is I wish I heard about this 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 6 years ago.
Right.
So it's extremely common for someone to come to me with a fixed split. And it's called a retrofit. And a retrofit, you go back in time and kind of recreate the past and see where you are, and they'll tell you how many slices you have. Whatever allocation you have, it doesn't really matter because there's no value in owning stock in a company that has no profits or dividends or any potential to sell. There's no value there. You could argue voting rights, but there's no real value in owning it. So all a fixed split contract does, it gives somebody the right to be a jerk. So once I'm faced with fairness, I can just adjust my split pretty easily, unless I want to be a jerk about it and hold on to my share, which happens sometimes, but there are ways to work around that, but that's one of the most common.
I love it.
What's nice about slicing pie is you don't have to necessarily even know the person you're working with. There was a great story that this guy posted an idea to Reddit a few years ago, and someone responded, and the two of them started a company together, having never met each other, sight unseen, using slicing pie, and it wasn't 6 months until they met for the first time, and they flourished because there's no risk in the model. They just work together. And I see that a lot too.
I love that. Now, you've created a pretty extensive resource center for this. Would you share kind of what that is? And just because I really want people to, I think this is a fantastic thing that you have documented here and adapted and created. Would you share how people get a hold of you, how people, you know, can access these resources and what those resources include?
Sure. Slicing Pie is free. Anyone can use it for any company anywhere in the world. And I try to provide as many free resources as I can. I got videos and I got spreadsheets you can download and samples of the book. And I try to give away as much as I can for free, but I do like making money like everybody else. So there's software on. There's a software called the Pie Slicer where you can sign up. It's a software as a service that keeps track of your split. Think of it as accounting for money you don't spend. So it keeps track of your unspent portions.
Is that pieslicer.com?
It's slicingpie.com. Slicingpie.com.
Okay.
And there's books and everything available. And you can also set up phone calls with me. I do consulting calls. They're paid calls, but if you need a free one, I'll give you a free one sometime. So again, I want to make as much access to it as possible for free, and then you can make your life a little easier with some of the paid tools.
That's really cool. Now, what are you doing now? What are you working on in addition to this, or is this kind of the primary thing that you're involved with right now?
Well, I'm working on the new book. I teach a few quarters at Northwestern University. I teach entrepreneurship and marketing at Northwestern. I also run a camping goods company called Mosquito Oasis, where I sell mosquito net tents for kids at summer camp. The summer's a little slow because there's not much summer camp going on, but
no kidding, right?
I got a garage full of product. My customers canceled a lot of orders this year.
Well, anybody that's listening or watching that needs any mosquito netting type equipment, that can actually be pretty cool. Like when you travel, it actually, even though it's quite functional, it's kind of romantic to have mosquito netting around the bed. It makes it feel kind of exotic and tropical. So I think we sell it that way.
I'm hoping that the mosquitoes start transferring COVID for us, so I'll get a little more business.
Right, exactly. So that's great. Then what I'd love to do is first ask you, are there any questions that you think I should have asked but didn't yet?
Your questions were great. You asked the right questions, and I appreciate it.
Okay, awesome. Then I'd love to open it up and see if any of our folks who are on watching this have any questions that they would like to ask. And I'm going to start with, it looks like we've got one here in the Q&A from Dave Senton. Dave says, I'm starting a partnership with two other people. I've made myself responsible for front-end deal structuring. Currently, I'm paying $2,500 to hire a consultant to help us design our outreach pipeline and fronting the software costs of about $8,000. So it sounds like about $10,500 that he's putting out there. Once everything is built and the deal sourcing starts, I can expect to be spending about 30 hours a week until we acquire our first business. I've been told it could take up to 4 months or close to 400 hours to fine-tune our pipeline and have it starting to make money. How would all of those front-end expenditures factor into to my share of equity using the slicing pie model? Am I factoring money invested as well as time invested?
Definitely. So it's you'll have time and potentially your idea if it's unique, you know, intellectual property, and you'll have your expenses and your payments to your contractors. All those things are essentially your bet, as if you're betting on your table. So you take all your non-cash expenses, multiply them by 2, all your cash expenses, multiply them by 4, and that's your number of slices in the pie. And anybody joining the company, if they don't get paid, they'll accumulate slices too. So it's you just got to keep track of what you're not getting paid and reimbursed, and that will be the basis of your pie. But time will, you know, over time, every day you show up for work and incur more expenses, you're placing more and more bets. That's the dynamic feature, is you don't know when the betting's going to end. It could be 4 months, could be 6 months, could be a year. Hopefully it's not too much longer than that before you start getting payout. But eventually you'll get revenue and you start paying your expenses over time, and then you won't have to spend your own money. So just keep track of those things, as you should be doing anyway, keeping track of your expenses and managing your expenses. And that'll all go into the pie.
Your SaaS that you mentioned, the SaaS that you've built to kind of help people keep track of things, does it handle both the efforts that people are making, that they're contributing, and the cash?
Yep, it'll manage your time, your royalties, commissions, you know, automobile mileage, you know, out-of-pocket expenses. There's even a feature called the Well. And the Well is a bucket of money that people contribute to for company expenses. So let's say we each put $1,000 in. When the money is drawn out, it'll convert to slices according to our ownership of the Well. Make sure that stays fair. So we each have $1,000, we draw, you know, $100, we each have $50 worth of slices added to the pie for us. So it's everything that you can manage is in there. And you get a couple of integrations, just like Slack and things like that.
You had mentioned in one of the books that there are expenses that really are kind of essential to the company, but also sometimes somebody might go out and buy pizza for everybody, and that's not really a contribution to the capital of the company, even though it's an expense that would be potentially a business expense that could be written off. So it's kind of like nice to haves versus essentials. Would you share a little bit how you deal with that?
Yeah, that's one of the things I wrote in the first book that I kind of renege on in the second book.
Okay.
If your expense is a traditional business expense account, so if you're buying pizza for the team and it's something that you would traditionally get reimbursed for, it counts. If you're buying anybody, you know, so you just got to be smart about what your decisions are. You know, if you work for a regular company and you go out to lunch with your boss and your boss buys you lunch or whatever, that's traditionally reimbursed. If you go out to lunch by yourself, it's traditionally not reimbursed. You know, so you just got to use whatever traditionally reimbursed.
And how do you deal with, like, particularly, and I see this in startups, is that sometimes there will be people who are happy working on the computers they've got, and then sometimes people want to buy a brand new Mac that's got like every single feature and advanced speed chip and everything on it possible, and they don't really need that. Technically, like from a tax standpoint, it is a business expense. It could be 179, but it's not really like they need that. Have you encountered that at all, where there's some challenges with that and how you deal with it?
It hasn't been a problem very much, but I always recommend people have a policy statements. You know, what are their policies? And your policy could be, you know, all companies have company policies, vacation policies, travel policies, mileage reimbursement policies, and an expensive policy of, you know, you can spend up to $500 without getting approval from your manager. You got to have some structure in place.
Yeah.
You got to keep in mind, though, that once you take slices for something, that becomes property of the company. Like if you have your laptop, you say, my laptop's worth $1,000, and they allocate slices for that laptop, that laptop is now the company's property. It's not yours anymore. So if you don't want to give it to the company, don't do that.
I like that. Okay. Eric asks, how do you manage fair market value for skill contributions? What prevents people from valuing their skill value beyond a reasonable level, or does it depend on just trust?
Well, you're negotiating this fair market value as if you're negotiating a job salary for any job. So think of it as if you're taking a real job with a company that can pay you. And you ask yourself, what am I willing to take? What's the job worth? What is, you know, someone flipping hamburgers is worth 10 to 15 bucks an hour. If you're really good at flipping burgers, maybe 16 or 17 bucks an hour, but not much more than that. If you're a neurosurgeon and you're doing neurosurgery for as far as you start up, then you're neurosurgery rates. If you're flipping burgers, you're flipping burger rates. So you just got to negotiate your salary that makes sense. One of the things that I see very often in companies is failure to take salaries into account. So I talked to a guy just last week who told me he was making $50,000 a year with his business. He was profitable. And I said, how much are you worth? And he said, $100,000 a year. So you'd actually lost $50,000 a year. So without your fair market salaries, that business is not operating properly. So I have to set a salary that makes sense for the business, that makes sense for your skill set, so that someday I can replace you if I have to. And that replacement value means that someone else come in and work for that amount of money with no equity. So you got to be smart about it. And if someone says, I can do computer programming and I want $200,000 a year, maybe I can find someone to do it for less, go overseas. So you got to set your prices as reasonable as you can, but fair. No one wants to work for free. No one wants to work for a diminished value over time. They want to work for a fair market salary. So always set the fair market value, because when you can pay it after break even or Series A, you will pay it and you'll be on the hook for it. So make sure you make smart decisions about it.
Love it. That's a great answer. Yev says, handshake deals seem common early on for experimental projects and partnerships. Let's see what happens kind of approach. How much of the slicing pie should be set in stone before traction based on future performance, or is the pie frequently revisited? I think the answer there is, Yev, is that's all the dynamic. That is the purpose of the slicing pie, but I'll defer obviously right to Mike.
All you do is say, let's use slicing pie, and you're off to the races, and you keep track of your contributions. And the things that you keep track of are things that most companies keep track of anyway. You keep track of your expenses. You should file an expense report, which is normal. You keep track of your salary, which you get paid. There's nothing new to track. You just track the things you track normally. Now, a lot of startups don't track these things because there's no money exchanging hands, but not tracking them gives them a false sense of what their cost structure is. So by keeping track of things, even if you don't spend the money on them, you want to keep those in account. You know, every business has to be financed, whether it's a handshake deal or a formal deal, or they all need financing. The way startups finance themselves is by not paying their bills. So just keep track of what you're not paying, and that's still part of your cost structure. So this is great for handshake deals. Just it is what it is. So we say we're using slicing pie. Here's our fair market salaries. What you don't want to do is handshake a guy and find out they were expecting $500,000 salary when you were expecting $50,000 salary. So make that decision up front. Right. That's very common not to. So just, you know, what are we worth?
Nice. And Doug asks, just to confirm, what sort of multiple do you place on replacement value of assets, I guess, that get contributed? That's really just going, I think, to what you were saying as what is, like, you put a multiple of 4 on some things and 2 on some things. If an asset comes in, like a computer or something like that, it's getting valued at how?
Well, so if it's non-cash, it does not require cash out of pocket. If it's cash, it does require cash out of pocket. So if I have an old laptop that I want to make part of the company, it's non-cash because I've had it sitting around for a while. So I'll use the resale value, like the Blue Book value or eBay. I'll look it up and see what the value is. If it's less than a year old, it's fairly new, I can use the purchase price as my non-cash contribution. If I buy it for the company, it's considered cash. So what we want to avoid is someone saying, you know, my computer is worth $2,000 and I spent $2,000 on it, so it's considered cash. And you can just throw junk at a company and call it cash. Cash is very specific. It comes out of your pocket. If it's non-cash, you use the resale value or the purchase price value in order to calculate your slices.
Fantastic. Well, again, I just want to thank you for taking the time to come and hang out with us today and share your wisdom on this. And it's such a wonderful thing that solves so many problems. It's just absolutely great. I love it. And it's slicingpie.com, Mike Moyer, M-O-Y-E-R. Mike, is everything at Slicing Pie, or do you have a podcast or social media or any other place you'd like for people to find you and learn about stuff?
I have social media accounts that I rarely use.
Okay. All right. So it's all slicingpie.com.
You can always ping me there, Twitter. Gruntfunds.com is my, @gruntfunds is my Twitter account.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you again so much. I really appreciate you coming here and hanging out with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Nice talking with you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. If you're enjoying the show, let us know by subscribing and leaving a review. And for more information, go to businesslunchpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.
What if 3 days could change the course of your business in 2023? Get Scalable Live is where you'll gain great clarity on the next steps that will help you create the business, life, and wealth you deserve. Connect with business owners and entrepreneurs just like you, hungry for advice, proven strategies, and necessary connections to grow a business.
Literally, million-dollar conversations are happening in the hallways, in the bathrooms, across tables.
Get Scalable Live at Fairmont Austin, November 2nd through 4th. Tickets are on sale now at GetScalableLive.com.